Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 48 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 64, and it will be mostly cloudy this Monday, May 10th, 2021. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, free speech radio, WBAI New York. Coming up next, a new day. Morning, we'll continue the story of how one baby found his family in the New York City subway. We'll welcome back to the show Danny Stewart, the social worker who found the baby back in August 2000, and we'll also welcome Peter Mercurio, his partner and author of Our Subway Baby, the incredibly poignant picture book that tells the story of how one baby found his home right here in New York. Stay tuned for headlines. I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do. Though I'm way overdue, I'd be stuck. Good morning, everyone. How are folks doing this morning? Y'all are drinking your tea, coffee, meditating. It's cloudy, might even be raining this morning. No, it's not raining, it's cloudy. But summer should be peeking its head out the window soon. This is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. On May 7th, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, a research center at the University of Washington, released a new report on the global excess mortality estimate of deaths caused by the coronavirus. The report finds that around the world, deaths have been drastically undercounted. This is IHME Director, Dr. Chris Murray.
Our understanding of the magnitude of COVID up to date is that it's been much worse than we have been thinking so far. So we have estimated that 6.9 million people have died from COVID already. So our understanding of the epidemic is quite profoundly changed by this shift to looking at total COVID. And that's because the scaling up of reported deaths to total COVID deaths is not uniform in the world. It's a function of testing, and it's also a function in some regions where the measured data tell us that the underreporting of deaths is being truly profound.
In Europe, the study excluded data during 5 summer weeks when a heat wave made it more difficult to accurately estimate COVID-19 deaths. The study was also not able to use the reported all-cause-of-deaths data from Brazil, which has been plagued by an incomplete registration of deaths since the beginning of the pandemic. Therefore, the IHME was forced to use a secondary record instead. Other countries had even higher excess mortality to reported mortality ratios than the United States. Japan's death toll is estimated to be more than 10 times higher. In Egypt, under the yoke of a blood-soaked military dictatorship backed by the imperialist powers, the IHME reports that the pandemic has claimed more than 12 times the lives reported by that regime. And in Kazakhstan, the total COVID-19 deaths are at least 14 times more than the government's tallies. And in his 4th of July 2020 speech at Mount Rushmore National Memorial in South Dakota, former President Donald Trump blamed lying radicals in public schools for calls to bring down statues honoring Confederate generals. Trump called these radicals, or he declared that radical views of American history are a web of lies, unquote. That same month, former Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas introduced legislation that aimed to prevent the 1619 project from making its way into public schools. The 1916 project reframes the nation's understanding of itself by placing slavery and its consequences at the very center of U.S. history. That's slavery and its consequences are placed at the center of U.S. history. That's the object of the 1619 project. This year, bills to ban or restrict the teaching of critical race theory and other subjects deemed, quote, divisive, including the 1619 project, have been drafted in Iowa, Louisiana, Missouri, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, West Virginia, and other states. Bills have already passed in Utah, Arkansas, Idaho, and Tennessee, and 2 bills are now moving through the Texas legislature that would bar the teaching of critical race theory. This is State Representative London Lamar of Tennessee.
It's uncomfortable for Republicans to talk about race. And in their attempt to not be held accountable for the historical implications of racism in this country is just unfathomable. I spoke on the floor today because the House sponsor said in his debates on this bill that an anonymous young white girl felt trauma because she felt like an oppressor based on the history of white America and what we've done regarding slavery. And while I don't want any child to feel any sort of trauma, I took this opportunity to bring to light the trauma that Black people feel living in America. Black children grow up knowing their whole American history, that the majority of the American history that we live today is of Black people being slaves. Or that more recently, our grandparents' whole lives were living through the civil rights movement, where they had to drink from colored water fountains, where they couldn't vote, where they were being lynched, where they were being killed, where they were being denied housing, food, and other basic necessities. And most importantly, our whole criminal justice system in America was built on the oppression and the systematic criminalization of Black people. So no, we can't just scapegoat or whitewash history so those white Americans now don't have to feel the repercussions of 400 plus years of enslavement and what that's done to a disadvantaged population such as mine, what we have to do is have these conversations in educational settings to bring context to our students so that we can remember what happened in American history so we won't repeat the horrible things that happened in American history. And the fact that we're trying to change laws in order to not have a conversation about race is just wrong and is downright offensive.
Critical race theories, that was a powerful statement. Let's just say that. That's State Representative London Lamar of Tennessee. And critical race studies is a discipline that matured in the 1990s, developed and popularized by black activist attorneys and legal scholars. It builds upon and upholds the findings of a large body of scientific, sociological, and historical research, which long ago established that race is not a natural, biologically grounded feature among human beings, but a socially produced category or way of seeing reality that justifies oppression and exploitation of people of color. And in fact, the scientist who determined that race is not a biological category, a significant biological category, is Stephen Jay Gould, who wrote The Mismeasure of Man. And this past Friday, May 7th, the Texas House of Representatives voted to make it harder to cast the ballot in a state that already has some of the nation's most restrictive voting laws. On Saturday, leading Democrats and hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Texas state capitol to oppose voter suppression, advancing toward approval in the Republican-led legislature. That's voter suppression legislation that's right now advancing toward approval in the Republican-led legislature. Former Representative O'Rourke said, quote, "This is the single greatest attack on our democracy, not just in our lifetime, but perhaps in the lifetime of this very democracy," unquote.
This bill, if it passes and becomes law, is going to make it a lot harder for a lot more Texans to vote in a state that is already the toughest to vote in, bar none, in the United States. We've had hundreds of polling places closed, the toughest voter ID, racial gerrymander, the closure of drop-off ballot boxes during the pandemic that has killed 50,000. And now they want to make it harder for shift workers, harder for people of color, harder for disabled Texans, harder for the elderly, and harder for those who live in big cities to be able to vote. So this is an attack on our democracy, and this is the response. You have hundreds of Texans driving from as far away as El Paso, 8.5 hours to our west, to be here today to stand up for this state and every voter, Republican, Democrat, independent within it.
As passed in the Senate, the Texas Senate, the legislation restricts early voting rules and schedules, eliminates extended hours, and bans drive-through voting. It also requires large counties to redistribute polling places under a formula that could move sites away from areas with more Latinx and black residents. Critics say the measures are comparable to abuses under Jim Crow, an era in which the white political power structure in Texas and other southern states used tactics such as the now unconstitutional poll tax and literacy tests to suppress votes and voting by people of color. This is Ray Martinez, director of Texas Rising.
We continue to organize. We're going to be there. We're going to meet them at every step of the way that this legislation moves forward. We're going to let them know that Texans are not with these bills. This behind me, these folks behind me, are a representation of the thousands, hundreds of thousands of Texans who would lose their right to vote if these bills were passed. So we will be meeting them at every step of the way.
And a new day will follow this developing story. It's 7:14 and 48 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day.
inch apart, held to a vertical bar, as we stand yawning at the center of the empty car. Under a flickering light, I watch you closing your eyes. The rumble of the tunnel really sounds quite nice. Sway left, sway right, slow dancing in the middle of the subway. Fall back, hold tight, slow dancing in the middle of the subway. Sneakers and nice leather flats, shuffle along to the track, switching partners kind of awkwardly up over and back. Just people following signs, riding on colorful lines, braving smiles across the aisles, past the suits and size. Sway left, sway right, slow dancing in the middle of the subway. Fall back, hold tight, slow dancing in the middle of the subway.
That was Subway Song by Juliana Zaccario. Perfect song this morning for this story. I wonder who found this song. Was it Ellis Maxwell or Marcos Maldonado Cruz or perhaps someone else? It's just Ellis Maxwell, I'm told, found this beautiful song for this story. Some babies are born into their families. Some are adopted. This is the story of how one baby found his family in the New York City subway. These are the opening lines of a touching new children's book, Our Subway Baby, written by Peter Mercurio and illustrated by Leo Espinoza. It tells the story of a baby who was found in the New York City subway by a social worker back in 2000. On the 14th Street ACE line. And we brought you the story a few weeks ago and loved it so much that we decided to bring back its protagonists to explore its other dimensions. Danny Stewart is the social worker who found the baby. He teaches at the Silberman School of Social Work at Hunter College. Peter was his partner at the time. Peter is a New York City-based writer, husband, and dad, and that's Mercurio, Peter Mercurio. He's the author of Our Subway Baby, a children's picture book published by Dial Books for Young Readers, an imprint of Penguin Random House, and Our Subway Baby is a Lambda Literary Award finalist. The book made the 2021 American Library Association Rainbow Book List. Danny and Peter, welcome back to A New Day.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having us.
Yes, good morning again. Thank you, Johanna.
Good morning. So I wanted to start with Peter this time. Peter, take us back to August 28th, 2000. It was a Monday. I looked it up.
Yes.
When you got a call from your boyfriend at the time about a baby he'd found on the subway, what went through your mind? Like, I'm thinking about it now. Got a call, found the baby. What do you do? What do you think?
Well, it was, there was such a tone to his voice that I knew he was serious right away. Danny doesn't really joke around too much. He wouldn't play a prank or a trick on me or say something that, like that, if it wasn't true. So I, you know, I was hanging around the apartment waiting for him to come home to meet me for dinner, and he was late, about a half hour. So when the phone rang, I thought he was going to tell me that he was running even later. So when I picked it up and he just sort of blurted out, "I found a baby," I knew that he had, something serious was going on. And, you know, I finally got it, you know, I asked him, "Where are you? Where are you? Where are you?" And he finally told me what subway station he was at, which was only a block away from the apartment. So I ran down there to be with him and try to, like, he was having, he didn't believe that he had called 911 already. He thought that they didn't believe him. So he said, "Well, you should call 911. And I said, "Well, I'll just run down there. I think it'd be quicker for me to try to find help or a police officer on the street rather than to call 911 again."
And of course, Danny is a social worker, so the notion that he found a baby, it's real, right? He's a social worker. This is what he does for a living.
Well,
maybe not to this level.
Yeah, because then we'd have, you know, many social workers with babies.
Exactly.
That, you know, they're finding. Yeah. But yes, the fact that he is a social worker who, you know, his job is, you know, basically to help people, and that's his passion in life. And yeah, it's weird. It sort of made sense that he was the person,
right,
who found the baby. Yeah.
So through some strange twist of fate, the judge presiding over the case of the subway baby, of course, we need to go to court to figure out what happened, get as much information as possible, ask Danny if he wanted to adopt the baby. And Danny said yes. Well, backtrack. In fact, in New York, if you find a baby, if you find a child, you are immediately given the right to consider adoption. And we learned this from Danny last time. So, Peter, can you tell us again, what did you feel when you got that call?
Well, he called me right after he was in court, and was completely surprised by the judge asking that question. And he was calling from another subway, from another payphone on the subway platform. He was heading back to work. And he said, "You're never going to believe what the judge just asked me." And I said, "What?" And he said, "She just asked if I would be interested in adopting." And just as he says that, his train, he needs to get on, is roaring into the station. And I'm screaming on the other end, "No, you know, go back. Don't get on the train. Go back into the courtroom and tell her, no, you misspoke." And, you know, my initial reaction was like, "We can't. There's no way. You can't do this. Why'd you say yes?" You know, we're not prepared. We live in a small one-bedroom apartment. We have no money. Just don't get on that train, go back to the courthouse. And he got on the train. And we didn't really talk about it until after work that night. You know, we get a chance to sort of regroup and have our, you know, conversation, in-depth conversation about it.
Okay. So we want to get into it because we're New Yorkers here. We want to know, Peter, were you pissed?
That's to say, I'll let Danny answer that. Yeah, just to put it mildly, yes, he was a little bit.
Yeah, that would be an understatement. I was really, really ticked off and pissed off. I was like, how could you say yes without consulting me? And he was just basically like, it just felt like the right thing to do. And I kept saying, yeah, but this affects my life too. And he was just saying this was the right thing to do. And I just felt in the moment I had to say yes. And I just said, yeah, but you could have said yes, but I'd like to talk with my partner first. I said, you could have like added that to the end of the yes. All of my resistance and being pissed off was all completely because I was scared to death. You know, I was really like, how are we going to be able to do this? Do I want my life to change? Do I want our lives to change? And it was about a week. We had like heated discussions almost every night and morning. When we got home from work and before we left for work in the morning, that's all we would talk about. And, you know, Danny was just sort of like, how can we say no?
You know, Danny was zen about this. Danny knew.
Crazy.
Danny knew. Crazy. But wait, so tell me about your life, Peter. Because usually the lives we lead tell us in our hearts or in our brains, yes to the baby, no to the baby. So what was happening in your life that you were absolutely not? No snowball's chance in hell. We can't do this.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense with my life. Talk to us about your life at the time.
That's right. In the year 2000, so in late 1999, I had decided that I was going to start a small nonprofit off Broadway theater company. And so I got, you know, I did all the tax stuff. I formed the company. It was legit. We had our first show that March. It did really well, you know, for an off Broadway showcase. It made money, which was unheard of. So we decided to do another show. And that was coming up in October of 2000. So that was sort of my baby. I was sort of like trying to nurture that and get that up and running. Of course, we lived in a small one bedroom with a roommate. You know, Danny and I were in the bedroom, and our roommate was in the living room. We had no money in savings. We had student debt, still had student debt that we're paying off. I just thought, okay, I want to focus my attentions, you know, in trying to get the theater company up and running and my writing career. And we have no business taking in a child or thinking that we can be parents without the resources or the space. And so those two things were in conflict for me. And then he just kept saying, you know, like before I said before, he kept saying, we can make it work out. We'll make it work out. And, you know, of course he was right. he usually is.
Oh, that's a first.
No, well.
That's a first. That's only because he's on the air, Danny.
No, what Danny does is that anytime we have a disagreement, and this was the biggest one I think we've ever had, really. We've never really had any major disagreements because we're pretty compatible. But even small ones, he's so patient, he'll just wait me out until I come around to see his point of view and I agree with him. I mean, it's just miraculous how he does it. He won't argue with me. He'll just like wait me out, and then I'll see things the way he sees them. So he knows how to work me.
That's really special. So what was the most challenging dimension of this dynamic for you, Danny, with Peter for a week? How did you feel about the fact that both of you seem to be on two different emotional tracks around this issue of the baby?
Yes. I mean, as Pete just described, I mean, in my head, I was thinking, well, this is a gift. We can't say no. And I was pretty resolute about that. And as the time went on and we continued to have these conversations, well, I thought, well, you know, I understood his fear. I understood his concerns, but I thought, well, you know, we will have enough time to plan and prepare for this. So that's what my approach was. I was thinking if we have enough time to make this happen, it's not going to happen overnight. And at some point I realized, well, even if Pete did not want to go through with this, I had made the decision that I would. So I understood what that might mean, is that that might mean that our relationship might end, but I felt like that this was the right thing over everything else, that I had to do this and that we should do this together.
And had you thought of having children together before? Was this a new conversation out of the blue, Danny?
Yes, we had not had any conversations. I mean, I think one brief one early on in our relationship. We had, have you ever thought about having kids? And it's like, yes, well, you know, maybe one day. It was not anything we were planning for. It was no notions that this was going to happen anytime soon. We felt like we needed to get our lives in a place that we could be ready to have a child. And we felt that that was somewhere down the road, but not anywhere in our immediate future.
Yeah, it was a possibility for the future, but not a strong desire at all to start. Yeah.
For you, Peter.
Well, I think for you too. When Danny and Kevin found each other, it became a very strong desire for Danny. I think it brought up a lot of paternal and parental instincts in him. But prior to Kevin, I think we both were like, well, maybe like 10 years from now, when we're in our 40s and more settled. And then, you know, we'll revisit this topic then. It was such a brief conversation that it wasn't even, I wouldn't even say it was a serious conversation.
And also being a gay couple, I mean, it was not, well, especially back then, it was not an easy thing to do. I mean, it took a lot of resources, and I in the back of my mind, I thought, well, maybe one day, but really thinking that it probably was never going to happen.
You're listening to the voices of Danny Stewart and Peter Mercurio, and we're talking about Subway Baby. They are the parents of Subway Baby. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. And we're going to take callers later on, but not just yet. So when I first spoke with you, Danny, I thought, 2000. 2001 is September 11th, right here, Ground Zero, not far from where you live. How did you navigate having a baby during that 9/11 moment? Danny.
Yes. Well, I mean, we lived right on the cusp of when 9/11 happened, that they, at 14th Street, that they shut down all of Lower Manhattan. They had National Guards set up. So it really limited, I mean, of course, for the whole city, it limited movement, but just to and going through the neighborhood, it really limited our ability. We were at this time foster parents, and we were moving towards adoption. And so when 9/11 happened, of course, family court is down near Ground Zero. So everything was shut down for months, and that delayed the process of our adoption proceedings probably for at least 6 to 9 months after that. So, I mean, as far as like navigating, it was a scary time. I vividly remember not only seeing the destruction and the horrific things that happened, but also because we lived in close proximity, we could actually smell the burning buildings for weeks afterwards. And it was just a nightmare. And then also, I don't know if you remember, but there was an immediate aftermath, and the day and the days afterwards, there was folks that were just looking for their family members and their coworkers and their friends, and they would put up flyers all over the place. And that happened in our neighborhood near St. Vincent's Hospital, which was the trauma center that they had set up to receive anyone that was coming from the World Trade Center. And I remember gurneys set up in the middle of the street with doctors and nurses just waiting. It never happened. And so people started posting up flyers near there on walls, on signposts, to with a picture of their loved one, if you've seen this person. And I just remember just being heartbroken by seeing all of this, and you know, walking through this day after day as we would go to our daycare provider.
Hmm. Yeah, that morning Danny had left to take Kevin to daycare, just our general normal routine. And I started to walk to work, and I had to walk up 6th Avenue. And while I'm walking up 6th Avenue, I just see everybody looking down 6th Avenue. So, you know, I turn around and see what's going on. And then I get to work, and I'm trying to get in contact with Danny, because Danny actually at that time worked downtown below 14th Street.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wanted to get in touch with him. Don't get on a train. So anyway, we ended up meeting at this daycare provider's. It was a family care situation, so it was at her apartment, and we were there for a while. And then Danny, Kevin, and I went home. And I think we've made a conscious decision that day that we had seen basically all we wanted to see. We didn't want to have the news and the TV playing on in the background with Kevin home. You know, he was, you know, just 1 year old, and we were like, let's just hang out with our son and play with him. And you know, so we just sort of, we built train tracks and because he had a whole Thomas Wooden train set, and we like spread it out all over the floor of the apartment. We just spent the whole day with Kevin playing with him rather than paying attention to the news and having it on in the background for Kevin to even see. We just, you know, we knew that his life, in our lives, but his life, he would not know really a pre 9/11 world, you know?
Hmm. So you understood the magnitude of what was going on, and you wanted to protect the baby at one from the potential trauma of that moment.
As much as he could have even discerned what was going on at 1 year old, you know, but we just felt like let's just not have it, you know, replaying over and over and over and over and over again.
So now part of what we've read in the press is that you told the baby the story of how he was found over and over again over the course of his mm-hmm. young life, and he came to love that story. He was enamored of that story. Can mm-hmm. can one of you tell us about that, maybe Danny, of how it was that you came to turn the story into a children's book before it became a book?
Sure. Well, we knew just the circumstances of his, how we became a family. It was widely known. I mean, it was very public about all of this. And so we wanted to reframe the story from of abandonment to being found, and that this is how we found each other. This is how we became a family. So we wanted the story to come from us and not anyone else. So we knew from the earliest times that he could even to understood, we would simply just tell him verbally, like how we became a family. And of course the subway stop is just one block away from where we live. So we were always going through that place, and we would always point, this is the place where we found each other. So that eventually turned into a children's book, a very simple children's book that Pete put together with trains telling the story of how we became a family, that the trains were animated, and they brought me down to the station. And that's where I found Kevin, using all of our names. And so this was just a really simple children's book. I wouldn't even call it a book, but it was just something putting together, like pages put together.
Color printouts, color spray glued together.
Well, this is the graphic artist giving the right terminology for what it's called. But we would read this to him every night at bedtime, probably like from 3 to 4 years old on. And then, you know, this was one of his favorite books that we would read, and he loved all kinds of books, but this one particular really used all of our names. And it was probably a year after reading it almost every night that it dawned on him that the story was about him. And he got so excited after reading it. And then he was quiet. He asked us, "Is this about me?" And so we paused for a second. And we said, "Yes, this is your story. This is how we became a family." And he got so excited. He just beamed. His eyes lit up. And he said, "Let's read it again."
Yeah. Then he owned it. He took it into school for show and tell. And he shared it with all of his classmates. And it was really wonderful because he actually helped another kid in his class, because we heard from a mom later that evening or the next day that she called. And, you know, of course, we thought that there was going to be some sort of issue with him sharing the story. And instead, she said, "I just want to, you know, thank you. My daughter's also adopted, and she's been struggling with, you know, what it means to be adopted." And Kevin coming in and sharing his story and being so proud and confident in his story and poised has really helped her. In a big way to be more comfortable with her being adopted. So that was really special.
Yeah, just thought that was just so beautiful that this was a little gift that he gave to this little girl who was, you know, transracially adopted, and it really had an impact on her.
You're listening to the voices of Danny Stewart and Pete Mercurio. They are the parents of Kevin, the subway baby. And we're talking about how Kevin came to be their son. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. The call-in number is 212-209-2877. We're taking calls. 212-209-2877. Call us with your questions, your thoughts, comments. 212-209-2877. So I can't imagine that that you can really tell the story. It would take a lifetime to tell the story of how you raised Kevin. But there was a special moment during these years, 21 years, when Kevin suggested a special thing involving the judge who suggested that he be adopted by Danny and you, Pete. Can you tell us about that moment?
Sure.
We'll start with... Go ahead.
Yeah. So Kevin was officially adopted in December of 2002. And if you move ahead almost 10 years to 2011, when New York State legalized same-sex marriage, Kevin started seeing on, you know, of course, on the TV news, all of same-sex couples getting married by judges. It was making a lot of, you know, news. And so on a walk to school one day, I had asked him, I said, do you think your dad and I should get married? What do you think about if your dad and I got married? And he was just like, "Yeah, you guys should get married." And the next thing out of his mouth was, "Don't judges marry people?" And because he knew of the judge from the, you know, the little spray glued picture book that we had made for him and he was reading all these years, he knew that there was a judge involved in his life that had, you know, brought us all together. So I knew what he was getting at when he asked that question. So I said, "Would you like to meet the judge who finalized your adoption?" And he nodded, and I said, "Okay." And then he raced off to school, went in the building. And I went home, and I found a general email address for Manhattan Family Court. I sent an email to this general address saying who we were, reminding them who we were, reminding them who our judge was, and, you know, if she would be interested in officiating our marriage. And a couple hours later, I heard back from a court representative saying, we got the message to your judge. Of course, she remembers you and she would be delighted to officiate your marriage. So, you know, 10 years later, in July of 2012, we were all there in her office to get married. Kevin was there. He had a ring in each of his pockets.
He was the best man,
the best man for both of us. So he had a ring in one pocket for his dad and a ring in another pocket for his papa. And so we're walking into her office, and this is, you know, Kevin's really excited because here is the woman that he'd been reading about in this children's book earlier in his life coming into real life. This is a real person. And he's nervous to meet her, and the judge is nervous to meet him because here's someone that, you know, she placed in a family, and she's not exactly sure how it turned out, how he's doing and what kind of kid he is and if everything turned out fine. I mean, so we all sort of enter into her office, and Kevin comes up to the judge and he sticks out his hand to shake her hand. And she just sort of breaks the ice and says, you know, looks at his hand and says, can I give you a hug? And so they hugged each other. And it was like, that was sort of like the ceremony before the ceremony, you know, mm-hmm. just watching mm-hmm. the two of them greet each other was really, really amazing, because here are two people that just impacted and affected and enriched our lives more than anything in the world, you know, sort of seeing each other. I mean, they met the day Kevin was adopted, but you know, on his adoption day, but he was two years old. Yeah. And has no memory of that. So, and that was the only brief time that the judge met Kevin as well, was at our adoption day. So seeing them together and to be able to like chat with each other and sort of, you know, see her ask Kevin, how are things doing? What are you into? How's school? What do you like to do? Just seeing their little chit chat was just sort of, you know, the small talk was special talk to us, you know?
Danny, what do you remember of that moment?
I just was in awe that like another thing is happening that I could not believe that would be happening.
Yeah.
This woman, the very reason that we are a family is once again the reason that we're getting married. And it was just full circle. So I could not believe. I was in total disbelief that this was happening. I mean, it was utter joy also. Mm-hmm. And I just was just overcome with so much joy and happiness in the moment. You know, we had prepared our vows, you know, written out for each other, and we both had a hard time getting through them. It was just a private ceremony that we had in her, you know, in
because
her,
we were crying so much.
Yeah, we were crying so much.
They were difficult words to say. Very easy words to say.
but it was a really magical moment. And this woman has been such an influential part of our lives. Still to this day, we still keep in contact with her, but she's definitely a special person to us and to our family. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I usually have listeners who call around the clock, but they're being shy this morning. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. What do you all feel about this story that's so heartbreaking and beautiful? Can you talk to us about Kevin? Who is Kevin? What is his personality like? When did you become aware of his personality? What can you tell us about Kevin? And I know that you probably want to protect him, but I'm wondering if he's embarrassed that his parents are now talking about him to the world.
That's a good question.
I think he's used to us talking about him because we never... all through his childhood, anytime anybody ever asked us about the story, we would never hesitate to talk about it in front of him. We wanted him to always be comfortable with how we became a family. So it wasn't like if somebody asked us about it, we would shield Kevin from knowing about it. So he's always heard us talking about him.
But currently, I mean, with everything going on, he's quite amused with all the media coverage and just the attention of it all. I mean, to him, this is just his everyday life. This is how we became a family. So for him, he doesn't think it as special, as remarkable as it is. Now he does, he's starting to understand the impact that it's had on folks, on people around the world. But it's been a distraction for him. He's in school, and we don't need it. He doesn't need it to be a distraction. We don't need it to be a distraction. He needs to focus on school. But as far as like everything going on, he's really been amused by all of the media attention and his personality. I mean, we learned early on of his personality that he is he's very much of a self-soother. And what I mean by that, I think he learned early on when he was with the foster family for the first few months that he wasn't necessarily getting the attention and care that he needed. So he never cried. He never, and he would always just soothe himself to figure out things as well. So he would always, from the earliest time, if he wanted to figure out how to do something, he would sit and go through the steps until he could do it. And that he taught himself how to do magic tricks, to play the guitar, to play the piano, to solve the Rubik's Cube. You know, he would just, he would be so systematic in doing the steps. And as in school, we would hear from the course, you know, parent teacher conferences, we would hear from the teachers about how he's doing, but then they would also tell us about like his personality. And it was like, you know, your son has got a really dry sense of humor. It's a very sophisticated sense of humor. Most of the other kids don't really appreciate it.
They don't get it,
but we do, and we love it.
Yeah, wow. He's pretty unflappable. He's really unfazed by everything that's going on right now. He's not embarrassed by us talking about it. He's proud of the story. We gave him the book when it came out. He had no idea. He knew the book was being written and illustrated, but he had no idea what the content was and how the story was being told. And you know, we gave it to him when he went to school last fall, and he texted us a week later and he said, I love it. I'm really proud of this book and I can't wait for you guys to share it with everybody.
We've got a caller. Let's take this call because we're going to have to wrap up soon. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Judith, the Upper West Side, and I'm looking forward to the day when he himself, Kevin, will be interviewed because this is absolutely fantastic. And what public school was it that he attended elementary?
Yes, so we were zoned down in the Chelsea Village area, so we were zoned for PS41. And so he went to PS41 for elementary, and then he went to continued in public school at Lab Middle School and Lab High School.
Wonderful.
In Chelsea.
The best schools. I was a para in 41.
Oh, you were? Yeah. Were you there when Kevin was there?
No.
Okay.
No. But this is very exciting and wonderful, and I look forward to seeing that book. My God. Okay, I'll get off so others can speak. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So Kevin is now 21 and in college. Tell us more about Kevin, and I'd like to play the last remarks that Danny left us with last time. But anything else you'd like to share with us about Kevin?
Just like Danny said, he's just very goal oriented. Right now he's a junior in college. He's finishing up his spring semester. He's double majoring in mathematics and computer science. He has, talk about goal-oriented. He decided he wanted to run a marathon, and now he's run 3 or 4 or 5. How many he's run?
We've lost count.
So, because some of them have been virtual. So he decided I want to do that. He's the captain of his ultimate frisbee team on campus.
And that's really where he spends a lot of passion, time and energy and passion is involved in that.
He's really passionate about Ultimate.
And in the immediate future, this summer, he's going to be doing a math internship with one of his math professors for 10 weeks. And so he's really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And so all of these things you mentioned earlier, guitar, piano, Rubik's Cube, self-taught?
All yes, self-taught.
Everything.
Yes. We never even
suggested
no lessons. No suggestion, no lessons, no, not even suggestion. You know, even when it came time for him to study for the standardized testing, you know, no matter what age it was, SATs or whatever, he would say, can we go down to Barnes & Noble?
And he would buy books and
just study on his own. I hate to say this because I don't want to make other parents mad, but he was one of the easiest kids in the world to raise.
Wow.
I mean, just remarkably easy and self-motivating in every way. We never had to remind him about anything.
I want to play Danny's last words to us during the last show. Let's take a listen. We'd like to have you back to talk about more. We want to know now. This is our nephew here at WBAI. Tell us just some final thoughts in 30 seconds what this has meant for you.
It's really an understatement to say that this has been the most transformative experiences in my life. And I think the greatest gift that I've received, besides the gift of this baby and this young man now, has been the gift of being able to view the world in the eyes of a parent. And I used to think, and I was a social worker, that I really understood empathy, but I really didn't understand it to the depths of what it's like to actually have a child and view the world through their eyes. And so that has been a great gift that has been transformative me professionally and personally.
Danny and Peter, thank you so very much for joining us and for the amazing work you've done over the last 21 years.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you very much, Joanna, for having us.
Danny Stewart is the social worker who found the Subway Baby. He teaches at the Silberman School of Social Work at Hunter College. And Peter Mercurio was his partner at the time, now his husband. Peter is a New York City-based writer, husband, and dad. He's the author of Our Subway Baby, a children's picture book published by Dial Books for Young Readers, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Our Subway Baby is a Lambda Literary Award finalist. The book made the 2021 American Library Association Rainbow Book List. Hopefully, we'll get to speak to Kevin one day. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to non-commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:57 and 48 degrees in Central Park this morning, Monday, May 10th, 2021. We're rebuilding the world together and ushering in a new day. This show is produced by Ajamo Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, and Marcos Maldonado Cruz. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with Nick of Time by Bonnie Raitt. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you on Wednesday.
What a story and what a radio station. WBAI, New York.
A friend of mine, she cries at night and she calls me on the phone. Sees babies everywhere she goes and she wants one of her own. She's waited long enough, she says, and still he can't decide. Pretty soon she'll have to choose. To run.